Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. How bad is the retail outlook? One story. Giant Linens and Things just went bust, held a bankruptcy auction for its 85 store leases, got interest reportedly in only five of them. That's 80 empty stores, with more big names, we're told, headed down. The real wave still to hit. This hour, On Point, bracing for retail meltdown. If the consumer-driven economy is history, what do we do with all those stores, all that real estate? Later in this hour, we'll hear from Julia Christensen, who's tracking Kmarts in Buffalo and Charlotte and a Walmart in Laramie, Wyoming, all turned into schools. Big box reuse, she calls it, and it's spreading. But first, joining me from Seattle is Patricia Edwards. She's a retail analyst and chief investment officer at Storehouse Partners. Patricia Edwards, welcome to On Point.
It's a pleasure to be here, Tom.
It's great to have you, but we've got you here at a tough time. How are retailers looking at what's coming? What's already here, Patricia?
You know, it is really an unprecedented time in retail at this point. When you look at the landscape, so many companies have already gone under, but they really are just starting to feel the pain throughout most of retail. What happened is the credit crunch has really not only just affected the consumers, but affected the retailers themselves. Retailers use credit to buy their goods ahead of time in order to get them into the stores and then turn around and sell them to the consumers. They haven't been able to do that in some cases. And then on top of that, the consumer has pulled back in a way that we haven't seen in at least 20 years and perhaps longer.
Who is boarding up already? Who's in trouble, Patricia?
Well, we've already seen Stephen Barry's, Whitehall Jewelry, Mervyn's, Linens and Things, as you mentioned, Sharper Image, Lilly and Vernon, Boscov's in Pennsylvania, and Bombay Company go. Circuit City is closing 20% of their stores, hoping to avoid a bankruptcy filing. There's not a lot of hope that they'll get there. And then if you start looking at the rest of the chains out there, there are a lot of retailers who have definitely put their growth on hold, but are overstored anyway. So places like The Gap, where there are over 3,000 stores, if you look at all of their various concepts that they've got, that is too many stores and too much real estate space, and I would expect to see them pulling back, for
example. I'm looking here at the ABC News Consumer Confidence Index, now at negative 50 on a scale of plus 100 to minus 100, the lowest record low in 22 years of polling set this year, and this very near it. You call it a consumer's Katrina, which means, I guess, a retailing Katrina.
Really, that's exactly it. You know, if you think about the economy, 70% of the economy is consumer-driven. And these consumers are under pressures that they've never seen before. Take gas, for example. We know that there were high gas prices back in the 1970s. And we know that gas prices have come down in the most recent past. They're down 30% from their highs in July. But if you go 2 years back, they're still up 30%. We know there's been food inflation. We know that consumers are having trouble with unemployment. We know that they have mortgages that are resetting at levels that they can't pay. They've maxed out their credit cards. The credit card issuers are bringing their limits in. Rates on those credit cards are going up. And we still have another wave of adjustable rate mortgages that are going to start resetting in 2009. When you take a look at that landscape, there is no way that the retail landscape that we see today is going to be the same in another 2 years. It's going to take a long time for us to come through it, and there's going to be a lot of changes.
Patricia, that, you know, we're accustomed to hearing retail reports as kind of humdrum news, sort of rolling along in recent decades on a general growth curve, and they'll be up this much or that month and so much, and sometimes people are scared, sometimes they're not. But this notion of the consumer-driven economy kind of coming to an end, or at least to a very long stall, as you say, that suggests some kind of fundamental change in the economy. How does a big retail analyst like you look at that? I mean, will it ever be the same again? Have we seen in the last, 2 years, the high watermark of something that may never come back? What?
Well, I think it'll certainly come back. I mean, consumers are who consumers are. If we have money speaking as the royal we, we're going to go out and spend it if we can. The problem is that we have dug such a trench for ourselves that it's going to take a while filling that trench back in before we can even get back to some semblance of normalcy. And so I think in the meantime, it's going to be the retailers that sell food and necessities and the hot must-have items that are going to do well. Other than that, you know, do I need another jacket? Does the average woman, you know, need more clothes? Probably not. It's only the new special stuff that's selling. And I think that that is going to drive a lot of these changes that counted on the consumer always being there into a very serious hurt, if not bankruptcy.
So looking forward, I mean, every trend has winners and losers, or survivors and those who don't survive. Talk about brand names for us. You mentioned Circuit City in trouble. We've heard of those who are already going to go. With the trends you see, what kind of brand name retailers are likely to do well or better in this instance, and who's likely to face trouble, maybe worse than trouble?
Well, you know, I think you have to look at the retailers who have the best systems, who have the offerings that consumers must buy. So if you even look at the last 6 months worth of comparable store sales, it's the retailers who have been selling food, which we all need on a daily basis, that have done the best.
So you're talking supermarkets or big box stores who sell food plus new socks?
Food plus new socks is the big winner here. So we're talking Walmart. We're talking Target, although Target's had its own issues because they don't sell as much food as Walmart. Mm-hmm. Costco, BJ's Wholesale. Even the dollar stores are really coming to prominence because there's a lot of stuff that you can buy at the dollar store for a lot less than you can even buy it at Walmart. Then you take that concept and you go into the clothing space. And really, the only company that has had consistently decent comp store sales in that area has been Aeropostale. Now, you know, that's not a household name, but Aeropostale is the bargain teen retailer. Mm-hmm. And they're offering something that no one else can. They're offering good quality clothing, but at a discount price. And that is taking share away from their competitors.
Patricia Edwards in Seattle, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from New York City, Jonathan Miller. He's an expert on commercial real estate and author of the Emerging Trends in Real Estate 2009 report, just out this week from the Urban Land Institute and PricewaterhouseCoopers. Jonathan Miller, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So Patricia's describing the big trouble already here and more coming in terms of what's selling, what's not, who's going to be open, who's not. What about the real estate that underlies this? I mean, how many dark storefronts do we see now? What's coming? How big a change?
Well, let me start out by saying, you know, commercial real estate, including retail real estate, has been the last over the cliff. It started with housing. Everybody knows about the stock and bond market disasters. Mm. And real estate generally lags everything else, and that's the case this time. So now we're going to see commercial real estate led by retail and hotels suffer, followed by office and maybe industrial properties. So on the retail front, it's going to be a Darwinian environment. The weaker malls, the weaker centers, the weaker retailers are going to succumb. Most retail real estate will manage through. It's a real survival of the fittest environment.
You've said we're going to see dark anchor stores, dark storefronts. And when you say weaker malls succumb, what does that mean? Just grass in the parking lot, shut up, be done?
That means empty centers, yes. And that means problems for local governments and taxpayers and reduced tax base. So it'll be an issue in many places. But again, you know, the people point to, you know, negative trends and get caught up in tremendous gloom. And there certainly is more of that out there. But for most centers and most retail establishments, they are going to get through this, but it's going to be difficult.
In terms of the contraction, though, where are we?
We're just starting. This is going to be, I think, as Patricia pointed out, a 2 or 3 year event, and it's just starting.
You know, we're constantly reminded that we've been in a historic period of consumer-driven economy. Do you think the economy will return to that kind of consumer centrality, the kind of spending we saw with, the credit sort of blowout of the last 10 years?
No, I don't. When you talk about 70% of the economy being consumer-driven, that strikes me as being a zero-sum game. It's just not sustainable. And in this country, a lot of people are over their heads in debt. Housing, mortgages underwater, credit card debt because they've been shopping too much over their heads. You've got student loan issues. You've got car loan issues. Everybody is up to their ears in debt, and that is just not sustainable. And the government is up to its ears in debt, and that's not sustainable either. So we're going to have to shift, it seems to me, over time into more savings and less consuming. And yes, that's going to affect retailing in the long run.
We're going to hear about some radical repurposing of retail real estate. But what about just commercial repurposing? Do you see, I don't know, factories moving into old big box buildings or, you know, that kind of move away from consumption toward production, even within this real estate?
Well, I think it's too soon to tell exactly what's going to happen. The first thing is, as Patricia was pointing out, some stores are going to go dark. And as I pointed out, your weaker malls, some mm-hmm. weaker malls are going to just empty out. And what happened about 20 years ago is you saw these malls with grass growing out of the parking lot cracks and empty hulks and communities facing big holes in their tax revenue bases, then trying to do something to reclaim them. And I think going forward, you're going to see these places get turned into more mixed-use properties with residential and retail components, more 24-hour types of projects.
Jonathan Miller, hold the thought. Patricia Edwards in Seattle, Jonathan Miller in New York. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Julia Christensen, author of the new book, Big Box Reuse, about putting retail space to new kinds of utility. But let's take some calls first from Needham, Massachusetts. Steve is on the line. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Thanks very much, Tom. I appreciate it. Join the program.
Good.
I was a retail analyst back at when the dot-com bubble exploded. And at the time, it was clear that we were overstored. They were doors were opening faster than the population was growing, at a higher rate than the population was growing. Mm-hmm. And then that was exacerbated by the number of online-only retailers, of which now most have closed, mm-hmm. With the exception of retailers like Amazon.
So where are we going, Steve? What do you see coming?
Well, frankly, I don't see it coming back. There were just too many stores selling the same merchandise. Some of the larger retailers have tried to react to that by developing their own product to build some exclusivity into it. But smaller retailers aren't going to be able to do that. And you just need so many retailers selling the same things, and it becomes a price war. And if you start competing on price, the only one that's going to win that war is Walmart.
And that's what may be happening right now. Steve, let us hold that thought and get one more call here from Petersham, Massachusetts. Nick, you're on the line.
Thanks, Tom. Great
Hi.
Show.
Thank you.
You know, one of the problems I see with retail in this country is over the last 20 years, banks and funding outlets have only relied on or only serviced the largest of the block stores. All the medium-sized chains are gone. All individual stores are gone. And when you have a financial crisis like this and the big block stores start to close, it affects us greater than if you had many individually owned or smaller chains existing.
So what's the answer? Where are we headed? Is it like this all over the world, Nick?
No, because, I mean, if you take the number of comic books we print in this country, 20 years ago there were 140,000 places that sold comic books in the United States. Today, other than the few that are offered in Borders and Barnes and Nobles, there's only 1,800. And the numbers are small. We print 30,000 comic books per issue. In Indonesia, they print 600,000 to 900,000 of an issue because they have smaller, individually owned shops that sell them. People see them. They buy them.
So more corner stores on the other side of the world. Maybe we're headed back in that direction. Let me pick it up with our guest, Patricia Edwards. You first used this word overstored, which I guess I take to mean too many stores. So, but which is it? Do we have too many stores or too many big box stores? When you look ahead, what do we have excess inventory of, Patricia?
Well, I think the first thing that we have excess inventory of is the mall-based smaller specialty stores. There are way too many of those. Smaller stores, it's really interesting that the caller brings that up because that is something that a lot of the big boxes are looking at as the wave of the future. You can't put a Walmart in downtown Manhattan, and it's darn hard to do that for a Home Depot or a Costco. But Walmart and some of their competitors are looking at these smaller stores that are more like that corner store where they can put them into urban areas, maybe 20,000 square feet, and it becomes more of a small environment. That will probably be the only way that someone like a Walmart's going to be able to grow over the long term. The problem with the smaller stores that are more individualized, that aren't part of a big chain, is that they can't compete in this world of globalization. And so in order to go back to something that works, say, in Indonesia, you're going to have higher costs and you're going to have less globalization. Now, maybe that's a good thing, but we have gone so far the other direction that right now I don't see it happening anytime soon.
Jonathan Miller, how do you see the evolution ahead? I mean, what an irony if Walmart, after having killed off so many downtowns and small stores there and then built big boxes with huge parking lots at the edge of town, now would come back downtown with smaller stores? How do you see the commercial real estate stock that's been devoted to retail morphing in this economy, Jonathan?
Well, look, Walmart and the big guys are going to do what it takes to make money. And if it means kicking out the small guy or moving into new formats in different places, they're going to do it.
But we live in the environment they leave behind, and we care about it.
Well, that's true. But look, there's no way around the fact the next few years is going to be very tough, and you can't escape empty storefronts and empty malls. That's happening in every community around the country. And one area that you haven't discussed is the fact that these small mom-and-pop businesses mm-hmm. that run retailing that Patricia just alluded to, the survival of the fittest mode there does not look good for them. You know, they're the first line of getting pushed out. So that's a problem for a lot of small businesses in this country, unfortunately. And we're going to play through a period where we go through some tough times, and it will recover. But it's going to take maybe 5 to 10 years. You remember in the early 90s, we were going through a similar period. And, of course, the world was falling and we thought there'd be no department stores left. There was a tremendous revival. Again, I don't think we're going to see that type of rebound. But there will be a new day dawning at some point.
Oil no longer cheap. It was cheap then. If oil's on an upward path, it's down in the last mm-hmm. few weeks. But if it's mm-hmm. headed up, does that mean malls have a less important part in our society where you drive miles and miles to the big mall? You said mixed use. Does it bring it back to the local community or something else?
Well, I think a major trend going forward is the fact that we're going to see more vertical development, more mixed-use development. That means people living closer to where they shop, closer to where they work, out of necessity. And it's not just oil prices. It's because of congestion. People can't continue to be, in many places, cannot continue to be caught in traffic all the time and have to drive everywhere. Time is money, too, and people just can't sustain that, and businesses can't sustain that. So you're going to see more of this mixed-use retail, residential, office, more of a return to the urban cores and away from the suburban fringes. And yes, I think the old suburban mall format that was so prevalent coming out of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it's becoming more of a dinosaur, and we're going to be left with some very prominent, what I call fortress malls. We're going to go back to more of a community-based retailing.
Amazing. These are the rivers of commerce that shape the contours of our environment, and they're moving again. Let's get a call from Davenport, Iowa, and Susan. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Very well.
I'm thinking what to do with all the emptiness. The big box stores, the malls, our local business being taken from the heart of our community.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of a new use. If we are not going to be provided with what we really need for health, the opportunity and encouragement to stay healthy by either what I see as the entire so-called healthcare complex or by the pharmaceutical corpses,
okay.
We have the opportunity now to unite for our lives and turn these empty boxes into hopefully effective neighborhood health facilities, not to mention winter parks.
Like fitness facilities or health facilities
fitness
or something.
Facilities, but even the poor could be included. And effective doctors, effective physical trainers who will tell you, say, if you're pulling the muscle during exercise, they'll tell you how to unpull it.
Hey, you could put a lot of gymnasiums in one big Walmart. We've got a guest joining us right now from Oberlin, Ohio, who's got a great view on this. Julia Christensen is here. She's the author of the new book, Big Box Reuse. You can read an excerpt and see photos at our website, onpointradio.org. It's a tour of all the ways in which big box stores have already been put into new and different uses than they were built for. Julia Christensen, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thanks, Tom.
You hear our suggestion from Davenport, Iowa, take the big box stores, turn them into health centers. You've got at least one example of that already happening.
Yeah. In fact, I saw a health and wellness center in Princeton, New Jersey that was in a renovated Grand Union grocery store. And I also visited a senior resource center in a renovated Walmart building in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin.
Now, it's interesting. You're following a little bit of a different trend. The first big box stores, you remind us, built back in 1962. Kmart was there. Target was there and more. Some of those early big box stores just weren't big enough eventually. Walmart would move to a bigger facility, and communities have already had to deal with what to do with that empty retail space. That presents a real challenge for towns, doesn't it, Julia?
Right. Yeah. In my field research, pretty much every building that I've seen has been left behind, not because of failure, but because of expansion. And so the big box retailers that I've come into contact with have left the buildings when, yeah, they've outgrown them and they've moved into a larger structure, usually within a mile or two of the original structure.
But they've got the big box, the original one left behind. You've got reports of Head Start or Early Childhood Center, Head Start in Hastings, Nebraska, charter schools going into Kmart's in Buffalo and Charlotte and Laramie, Wyoming. Is that effective? Do kids really warm to walking across those vast, windy parking lots for an old abandoned Walmart to go to school?
Well, in every site that I have visited, the renovators have been very excited about what they've been able to sort of do in the building. And each case that I've visited has shown me that in some way it has been successful and it has worked for the community to use these buildings.
So how do they do it? How do they get control of a building and turn it into a school, let's say? They buy it from the big box company?
Well, the real estate packages vary, of course, from site to site. Oftentimes, the big box retailer will own the building and the land and the parking lot. Sometimes the land is owned by one real estate company, the lease is controlled by another, the building is controlled by another. So there are a lot of variations in how the real estate packages sort of function. So that really varies from site to site.
And do you see the kind of reuse that you're writing about in tracking spreading into other parts of the retail world, the built retail world, Julia?
Well, it seems inevitable, actually. I think that as the other guests have been saying, we're really just kind of at the beginning of this issue. And whether these buildings are left behind because of failure or because of expansion, the empty big box is something that we're just at the beginning of seeing in the landscape in this country.
Let's get a call from Morrisville, Vermont, and Hank. Hank, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think the day is over of one of each store in my town. We're experiencing, like, we have some land that's wanted to be developed, and it's always been for non-commercial, like retail.
Mm-hmm.
And they want some easements put on the property to change that verbiage, and I think that's a wrong move, because if you come into our town, a lot of the storefronts on Main Street are closed down. And I think, furthermore, it would happen worse if box stores came in. And because it's kind of a known fact that when the box stores come in, they lower their prices. And then when the other stores close down, they raise them, for both for lumber stores and also retail stores.
So it's happened all over. Maybe you're not so sorry to see the end of the one of each store in every town era. Hank, thanks for your call. Jonathan Miller, give us a little tutorial on how this works commercially. Julia Christensen is looking at examples where towns have actually stepped in some cases, to repurpose big box stores. But when you've got this kind of retail contraction and a lot of empty space, presumably that's also a commercial opportunity, or is it? Are these things just likely to stay empty? Or are we going to see, you know, flea markets popping up in empty anchor stores? How's it work?
Well, what has to happen here is local government and everyone has to come together and focus on these issues. And I think, you know, the trends are clearly back to the core. So there in Morrisville, Vermont, or in those smaller towns in Vermont, it's time to get away from the big box on the fringe and repopulate the stores at the cores that are more convenient for people to come to. But that takes local government to come together. And one of the big problems in this country is we've got lots of local governments that compete against each other for these stores. And on the outskirts, it may be one government, and at the core is the village, and they're competing against each other. And the result is you've got less for all. And so what we have to do is have more regional planning. People have to come together and look to build up the cores. That strong core, that convenient core, is going to be the strength of entire regions. And if we do that effectively, that will be good for everybody.
Patricia, do you see the built retail world as the right structure for the comeback when it ultimately comes in whatever shape it comes and scale? Do we have the right buildings out there? Or are business people going to be looking for some other structure? And if they do, what happens with what's standing there?
Well, you know, retail is constantly evolving. And, Tom, you mentioned gas prices. One of the things that we've seen is that there has been a rise of e-commerce. Now, it's not the same thing that we saw back in 2000 or 2001. These are e-commerce sites that are connected to a Costco, to a Walmart. And I think that when you start looking at the fact that people are using those more and that these malls are full of lots of little stores that aren't going to be able to compete over time, and perhaps some big anchor stores that aren't going to be able to compete over time, I think that some of that real estate is going to end up empty and we are going to need to repurpose it for something.
For something business? Or do you see sort of such a gaping hole that even in our resource-strapped time, civic uses may come to the fore?
You know, I've seen that out here. There is one mall in our region that completely redid itself into more of a community space, and we're seeing children's museums in old Mervyn stores and things like that. And I think that that is probably going to be the wave of the future for some of the space. It can be used for, you know, city halls, things like that. I'm not the expert on how the space is going to go, but I do know there's a lot of space and there's going to be a lot more soon.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about retail bracing for an economic meltdown, a retail Katrina, we're hearing in this hour, and what to do with the empty stores left behind. The ones empty now, the wave soon to be. Julia Christensen joins us. She's author of the new book, Big Box Reuse, and she's got a lot of really interesting examples there. Not exactly charming, but put to big new uses. Patricia Edwards is here, retail analyst from Seattle, Washington. Jonathan Miller, commercial real estate expert, joins us from New York City. Right now, Robert is calling from Bethel, Vermont. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Yeah.
I think I'm actually happy to see all this happening. I think it's a huge wake-up call for middle-class America. I think since Ford Motor Company's introduced the SUV, the big-box truck, the big-box car, leaving the big-box house, going to the big-box store, I think, you know, both the candidates running for president are both trying to support and give the confidence back to the middle-class America. But I truly think middle-class America has sold out on its own over the last like 18 years. About when the SUV was Ford Motor Company addicted the American people that they should be in these gigantic trucks.
It all did kind of fit together, didn't it, Robert? You could buy a month's worth of supplies at the big box store and create them home in that big truck.
Yeah, and I truly think that, and I you know, I look back and this is, I don't have great ideas. I really like the ideas that I'm hearing about the reuse of the stores and so forth, but I think the American middle class needs to wake up and say, hey, we really don't need that fake artwork we're buying from China. We don't need all this crazy stuff that these stores, like the one gentleman was saying, it's all the same merchandise just in different boxes. So I think, you know, the overindulgence is something that the American people need to look at because it's caused way misuse of credit cards and total overindulgence. I'm concerned about what we're going to do with the big box houses, let alone the big box stores, because most people know that right now can't even afford to leave their big box house now in their big box SUV.
Maybe subdivision
store.
Will take on a new meaning, Robert. Family
well,
on the third floor, family on the second.
I think, you know, a 15 or 2,000, you know, 2,000 square foot home with a reasonable sized car, driving to a local store in the local village. I have a village here in Bethel, Vermont that I love to support. But I think, you know, I truly think that, you know, the situation, even with Ford Motor Company, I hope Ford Motor Company goes down because they introduced the SUV right when they should have been doing all the new technologies for cars, for alternative cars. And what did they do? They spent billions of dollars marketing to the American people, convincing them that they had to drive this big expedition. Mm.
Robert, you're tough for a new vision there. Patricia Edwards, you're our retail guru. Does it make you shudder when you hear that, or is part of you nodding along with Robert? I mean, he's got a kind of a bring-it-on attitude toward retail trouble, but it, of course, it brings pain too, though it may bring a new way.
Well, you know, I think he's right. But I guess no one really forced middle-class America to this. It's kind of like saying that the college student that went to the party really didn't deserve the hangover because they had to go socially to the party. And so if they have the hangover, they should be given lots of aspirin. I guess I really think that it's going to be painful and it's not going to be a lot of fun. But, you know, Americans got themselves into the situation and they're going to have to live with the pain to get out of it. It is going to reshape the landscape. It needs to reshape the landscape. We are going to be like our great grandparents and like our grandparents who lived through the Depression. We're going to have a different set of values when we come out of this on the other side. It's the children of those people who went through the Depression who kind of really fueled this. It's the baby boomers. And I speak as someone who's on the tail end of that, who really got into consumption and never really had to think about conserving their assets because they had never lived through a time when they needed to.
Wow.
And that is going to reshape what we look like in the future.
Well, and you're the chief investment officer. Julia Christensen, give us a sense of, you've looked at a bunch of that reshaped landscape already. Give us some more examples of what towns, communities are doing with big box stores where the lights have gone out on retailing and the repurposing has moved in. Give us more examples, Julia.
Well, one thing that I think it is important to note, sort of going back to the civic reuse of these structures as opposed to the commercial reuse, is that a lot of times these buildings are implemented with leases that have future-reaching stipulations on them.
That
so
is when Walmart opens up or Kmart?
Exactly.
So like what?
If a Kmart were to open up in a structure, for example, they might sign a 100-year lease on the land. And in the lease, there might be stipulations for what the building could or could not be used for after they left in order to ward off competition. So a lot of times, commercial redevelopment of these sites is sort of tricky. And this is just, you know, from the field research, from what I've learned, stories that I've been told from town to town.
And towns accepted that if Kmart closed down, nobody else can move into that giant hulk?
Well, it's generally not nobody else, but it might be, you know, for 50 years, such and such can't move in. For 40 years, so and so can't move in.
Okay.
Lesser stipulations for lesser competition.
So what are people doing with those buildings?
Well, I have seen libraries, schools, as you said, museums, senior resource centers, all of these community uses moving in. And one thing that this sort of has reflected from place to place is sort of an auto-centric shift in these communities, which also might be on the fritz, but when a courthouse moves from the center of downtown out to the Walmart site on the edge of town, a lot of times the reason that's cited is accessibility by car. People say they can no longer park in the downtown center when they need to stop by the courthouse to do an errand. And so parking lots are often named as one of the main reasons that these community centers are moving to the edge of town. And a lot of these sites are also in smaller towns, or smaller towns that are a part of a larger metro area rather than a major city with big boxes on the outskirts.
You know, Julia, let me ask you an aesthetic question. I remember when downtowns were struggling, when malls were draining commercial activity to the edge of town, lots of empty storefronts, and then they would come back with little restaurants and boutiques. People were drawn because a lot of the economic life may have gone away, but they still had that sort of charming Victorian, often, architecture, those great brick facades and all that. I mean, really, who wants to hang out in an abandoned Walmart or Kmart? Isn't it kind of deadening architecture?
Right. Well, that is always the initial response. You know, in throughout my field work, over and over again, I go to a site and they say, oh, the community was so upset when they learned we were going to put a library in our old Kmart building. And over and over again, I've seen architects and community groups who have worked really hard to transform the building into their new community center. And it just sort of shows the power of the creative, resourceful communities that are all around us. But, of course, it also does bring to light this major issue that we have in the landscape, which is lots and lots of empty big box buildings.
I mean, God love them, but it looks like Blade Runner to me, staggering across those endless parking lots to get to an abandoned Walmart. That's somebody's idea of hell. Let's go to Susie in Litchfield, Connecticut. Susie, you're on the air.
Yes. My question is, first of all, I'd like to say I'm not a fan of the large box stores. I try to shop locally as often as possible. But when these stores do close or move on or whatever, my concern is if they are inhabited then by nonprofit organizations or schools or libraries, which would be wonderful, all of these people would be off the tax rolls. And what would that do to the town?
Yeah, that's a pointed question. Jonathan Miller, may we turn to you on that? If you get civic reuse, and or if they're just empty, what are the local tax implications of missing this retail activity?
They're very bad. And so it behooves local governments to try to find new uses for this space so that there are enhanced tax revenues. But you see, I don't think it's a one-off issue putting a health club in or a traffic office or a government
senior
building.
Center, school.
It is creating a new community based on the old and traditional village concepts, where you're creating a residential space with retail, with offices, and you're creating a community that's pedestrian friendly and that can work on its own.
Is that the mixed use you're talking about? Does that come into old malls? They get converted into condos and smaller stores? And
exactly. And you've seen that happen in parts of the country coming off of the early 90s retail debacle. I mean, these big malls are huge pieces of real estate. And if you get very creative about them and put first-class developers lining up with government officials, you can get these very attractive new types of mixed-use real estate developments that move away from the 50s, 60s suburban concept and come to what I'd call a more 21st century orientation. It's sort of back to the future, which creates these new communities that will work better going forward.
What an irony that the mall then emerges as the kind of less automobile-based, denser mixed-usage picture that a lot of urban planners have called for a long time. Let's get a call from Saranac Lake, New York, and Alan. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Certainly.
I just wanted to briefly relate our experience in Saranac Lake.
Yes.
We're a
pretty remote community in the Adirondack Mountains. It's probably, for some basic needs, people have to drive about 50 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically beat off Walmart, who were trying to put in 120,000 square foot super center, which
yep.
would have probably gutted the other retailers in the town.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, in the course of that, recognize that there was an unmet retail need in the town, and so we looked at other retailers who might be willing to open a more appropriate size store, and basically that was to no avail. So we decided to take our destiny in our own hands, and we're raising capital to open a community-owned department store.
And where will it be? Right downtown, Alan?
It'll be downtown, and it'll be appropriately sized for the town. And we currently have over 400 investors. We've raised about $320,000, and we're still actively seeking investors to reach our goal of 500,000, so we can actually open a store.
Alan, it's an inspiring story. Our time is short, but you're really taking your destiny into your own hands. Is the current economy going to get in your way, or do you think you can still do it in spite of the downturn?
I think we can do it because the alternative is driving a 100-mile round trip, and you know, if people can avoid those costs, they're going to prefer to shop locally. And also, by keeping people in the village, that will benefit the other retailers in the village. Mm.
Alan, thanks very much for your story, and good luck there in Saranac Lake. Let's get one more call from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Kevin, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Great program today, and I really appreciate hearing your guests.
Thank you.
I just want to make a couple of comments on this whole big box thing. And I know Jonathan mentioned this earlier. A lot of communities have competed to get these retailers that they enable, and often they did it with tax abatement. So quite frankly, I think one of these entities shutting shop and leaving town may not necessarily be all that bad, since quite frankly, they weren't paying full taxes.
Right.
As to redeveloping these properties, what's become fairly common over the last 10 years, a lot of these establishments have been built on brownfields.
That is environmentally polluted land.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the redevelopment for other purposes, such as schools, health facilities, probably even office space, I would question whether or not that would be a viable option for these properties.
Kevin, our time is short, but we will look at it. Julia, what did you find on this front? We have heard, of course, many of those stories of big box stores being built on brownfields, often with the sort of toxic underlay that gets slabbed over. Does that present an obstacle to redevelopment, Julia?
Well, in cases where that has happened, yes, it does present an obstacle. But the sheer number of sites that we're talking about means that there are hundreds of empty big boxes that can, in fact, be redeveloped for civic reuses. One thing that your last caller sort of brought up too was the fact that towns can take the power of design back into their own hands. And one of the things that I've hoped by raising a platform about this this discussion about big box reuse is that towns will realize that they can have power over the design of these retail structures. The corporations don't have to dictate all of this to towns, but inevitably, reuse can even be considered as a part of the original design. So the empowerment of towns, I think, is an important thing to happen now.
You've talked about towns insisting on landscaping and multiple entrances to big boxes at the beginning so that if they have to reuse them later, they're more palatable.
Exactly. One thing that's really hard in terms of reuse is finding a user to use 200,000 square feet of space. When there's one entrance, then it sort of dictates the single-use situation. But if there are multiple entrances on the front, it's much easier to break up into smaller sections to be reused for multi-use purposes in the future.
Wow. Well, an economy changes, and our world changes with it. Patricia Edwards, we're hearing a kind of a new picture of the American landscape being described right in front of us as as this economy goes through this very wrenching transition. What do you think, Patricia? Are we going to like it, or is it going to feel like, you know, the aftermath, the rubble?
You know, I think that the retailers are smart enough to know those that survive are going to cater to what it is the American public wants and needs. And it's not going to feel like Blade Runner or anything like that. But it is going to be a lot different than we see today. We're not going to have a mall on every corner. We're not going to be able to shop at all of the different choices that we have today. But we're going to have what we need, and the retailers are going to still try and entice the dollars out of our pockets.
Maybe with a very different shape and a skyline. Patricia Edwards at Storehouse Partners in Seattle, Washington. You are wonderful to be with us. Thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Jonathan Miller, author of the new Emerging Trends in Real Estate 2009 from the Urban Land Institute and PricewaterhouseCoopers. Jonathan, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Julia Christensen, author of Big Box Reuse. It's great. Julia, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.